Hey guys, John Paulamy here, Actionable Intelligence. Today is Saturday, April 22nd, and this is the weekly market update. Actually, it's Sunday, late Sunday. I'm putting this out a little bit late because of personal issues that took up my time on Friday and Saturday. But again, better late than never. This will be a little bit abbreviated, as you'll see. The disclaimer: anything that you hear or see on this video or podcast is not to be taken as investment advice. Please do your own due diligence. It's your money. It's your responsibility. Okay, so one of the things that I've been talking about is trying to understand the delay mechanism of interest rate increases and tightening liquidity in the economy. You know, as the Fed has tightened liquidity over the last year or a little bit more than a year now, you know, it doesn't all just hit at one time. It, as they tighten and tighten and tighten like a boa constrictor, it has more and more of an effect. It has a lag effect as it moves through the economy. And so, you know, I was trying to find or think about a good way to look at it or track it or see what the effects are. And then I came upon this guy. He was interviewed on Wealthion, I think Wealthion or somewhere else. I heard him speak. Michael Cantro is the chief investment officer at Piper Sandler. And he was talking about this HOPE methodology they use. And I haven't had time to delve into it deeply or study it. I kind of made my own little slides this week, but I'm going to delve further into this and kind of like figure out what they're really using or see if it's something that they just published that I found it very intriguing as a way to, in the way it was explained, at least the way I understood it, about how if you use this methodology, and I'll kind of just give a brief overview, how you can kind of see how as the rate, as liquidity tightens, as the Fed raises rates, how that percolates through the economy and how they show it via this HOPE methodology. And so what's it stand for? Well, the H is for housing. O is for orders, new orders, manufacturing orders. P is for profits, corporate profits, and E is employment. You know, and the thinking is that, you know, housing in the U.S. economy is a very large proportion of the economy, just because all the things that go into a house, not just the actual building of the house and the contractors and the materials, but all the other things, appliances and the furniture and all the little things you got to do, trips to Home Depot to buy plants and fertilizer, all the things you have to do if you're, if you own a home, you know what I'm talking about. And so it has a very, you know, disproportionate, I shouldn't say disproportionate, but it has this very, you know, wide net, if you will, a wide influence on the economy. And so I want to talk about this. Like I said, I have to do more research into this, but this framework kind of made sense to me. You know, housing being interest rate sensitive, as rates increase, it's one of the first places to see the effects of raising rates, right? Because as you raise the cost of money, you raise the monthly payment. And in our society, people don't just pay cash for houses or cars. They're interested, you know, they look at their income and they say, okay, I'm taking on this debt. How can I service the debt, right? And the interest rates, you know, when you were able to lock in 3%, you know, a little bit more than a year ago, and you're now paying 6 or 7%, you know, that's a significant difference. That's a doubling of your house payment at least, right? Or I don't know the exact, you know, how it transfers over, but it significantly increases the your house payment, especially as prices haven't had a chance to really come down yet. They're starting to come down, but not like we would think. And so, you know, the first methodology, this is, I just grabbed this off the Fred website. This is the St. Louis Fred economic data that they, Federal Reserve economic data. You can go there and just about call up any type of economic data point you would like, but you could see, you know, when they started raising rates back around this area, you could see since then, you know, the permits for new houses has have come down quite a bit. We're sort of down now. They popped here. You know, you just, and one of the things I'm going to say is, you know, I'll show this later on. You know, the millennial cohort is the largest current generation, right? This is the generation of people that's somewhere, you know, 40 and lower, you know, into their early 30s. They're starting their families. They're wanting to get out of apartments. They want to buy a house. And so there's a big pent-up demand for housing. We've, you know, coming out of the 2008 great financial crisis and housing bust, we didn't really make enough houses. There was a big period of time where we didn't build a lot of houses. And so the housing inventory is not sufficient for the demand for this new cohort, the millennials that are coming through as they start getting into their family formations, wanting to buy houses, kids, the whole shebang. And now with rates higher, prices really haven't come in enough to, you know, that's unaffordable for them. So, with rates where they are, it just makes it almost impossible for these folks. So, you will see, we'll track this, but this is what we expect to see as rates are, you know, if they continue to raise rates, if liquidity continues to tighten, then it's going to make things more unaffordable. Yes, you know, material prices have come in quite a bit, but is it enough to offset the higher interest rate? I don't know. You know, there'll always be demand. There'll always be some houses being bought and sold, even during the high inflation, high interest rate environment of the late 70s, early 80s. I can remember people buying houses and paying, you know, 15, the mortgage interest was 15 or 18%, something crazy like that. But because, you know, once you get married and your wife wants to have you, well, I should say the wife, but the family wants to get started, blah, blah, blah. And so you can't just be living in a, you know, two bedroom apartment with a bunch of kids and stuff. It's not the way to go. People don't want to live like that. So as soon as rates drop a little bit, you see a perk up in sales and permits and things. So it's something to watch because housing, like I said, it has such an effect on the broader economy. And it's one of the first places to see rates where rates impact the particular market. Okay, so the next thing was orders, and I'm using this. And like I said, I'm going to go back and do some more work on this. I didn't have time to do the work I wanted to do on this week. I'm just throwing up some things that I put together myself. I don't know if these are the exact data points these folks are using. I'll do some more refining of that, but I really thought it was good. You know, as how you know, as housing starts to contract, and autos are another area where high rates have a tendency to close off the market for new auto buyers, just because if you've been in any kind of dealership and listening to some of the conversations, it's always about what can you afford payment wise per month, not the actual cost of the vehicle. So rates have a very, you know, big effect on what people can afford for these big, large cap purchases, you know, houses, cars, things like that. And so, anyways, you know, you're going back to coming out of the pandemic, you know, we saw this big increase in manufacturing new orders because just the economy was, everybody was flush, you know, but we've seen it drop off. You know, anything under 50 is basically considered contraction. And so the last print in March was 44.3, which is well below. Now you can take this, I only took this chart back 3 years. You can take it back for any, you know, period you want. But, you know, manufacturing in the United States is in a recession already and has been. Now, manufacturing is not a major part of the economy, but it is part of the economy. There's, you know, a lot of jobs there, relatively high paying. And so it's going to be one of the first places you see another. What I'm trying to show is as the rates and tightening liquidity move through the economy, how they, you know, affect these different sectors at different times. And, you know, manufacturing starts seeing it right after, you know, these housing numbers. So manufacturing's contracting in the US, you know, even though it's maybe only like 15% of the economy, but it still shows you that, you know, we're not going in the right direction. And so I just grabbed this. I have to do more investigation on this, but corporate, the next thing, the P was the corporate profits, and profits from decreased 60, were basically corporate profits are down. We had this big surge coming out of the pandemic, which skewed all the numbers, and now we're kind of leveling off. But that makes sense, right? If manufacturing is contracting, if the housing market is, struggling, then other sectors, you've seen all the layoffs in tech, where is all this euphoria coming for this soft landing, for this no recession call? It's not, you had basically a decade of zero interest rates, and now we took them up to, Fed funds close to five or five, whatever it is, and then loads for houses and other things are substantially above that. So it's going to have a dampening effect on people's ability to afford these items, because the rates are now, don't allow for people to, with their incomes not increasing for years, they're getting priced out. And so you would expect to see, this start to happen, right? We've had a long period of time where corporate profits were exceeding the average that they normally do. And so we have this tendency to, or not tendency, but we're going to see more of a return to the, to the mean. We overshot to the upside. And so then, employment, the most recent employment numbers that came out, or jobless claims, weekly jobless claims increased 5,000 to 245,000. Continuing claims were up. This is just a blurb from the Reuters article that I'll post also here. It says the number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment benefits increased moderately last week, suggesting the labor market was gradually slowing as the Federal Reserve's year-long interest rate hiking campaign dampens demand. Yeah, this is what we'd expect to see. And of course, it's being talked down by the financial markets because they're, making, they're doing well. It's part of that, what we said at the start of the year, we would see this hop, if you will, and then a deterioration in the economy, which would lead to contraction in corporate profits, which would lead to contraction in the economy and layoffs, and then start getting into a self-reinforcing cycle until something breaks, or get into a situation where the recession is so obvious to everyone that the Fed then has room to cut. I think a lot of people, including myself, were thinking that we weren't going to, that they wouldn't be able to hold off from cutting rates, but things have held in pretty good. It's hard to tell. I think part of the problem is you can't really judge all that money that was pumped into the economy. There's still quite a bit of money circulating. But like I said before, we're now starting to see those lag effects of all these rate increases and this liquidity tightening starting to have its effect on the economy. I think when you look at the stock market and people say, well, the stock market's not, it's still doing fairly well. It's been up. I think that's true. Well, I don't think it's true. It is true. But you have to remember, it's mostly being led by, 10 or 15 stocks. There's not a lot of breadth to these move. Okay. It's concentrated in your large cap stocks and things like that. So it's not, as people still are wedded to this index, 288 a payday, and their employer matching goes in, it just buys the same 10 or 15 stocks. It's going to push the average up. So I think that's going to, I don't see anything on the horizon barring a catastrophe in the financial markets, like a resumption of the banking crisis or something like that, that forces the Fed to cut rates or to move from a contractionary liquidity to a, expanding liquidity situation. I don't see anything on the headlines. I just see the economy continuing to deteriorate and struggle, and it'll be self-reinforcing as the narrative shifts from, we can muddle through to a soft landing to, eventually a hard landing if liquidity continues to tighten. And so I think this chart here kind of shows you what I'm talking about. You see the Challenger Gray planned layoffs. This is in another article. I'll make the attachments a Reuters article. But you see the planned layoffs are increasing, and you see the actual initial jobless claims are starting to come. You know, this looks like a chart of some of our stocks in the portfolio, right? That went along and bottomed, and then they started upticking, and then they have a tendency to go. I would be buying this chart if this was a stock, if this orange line, you know, you had a thing that tumbled. It kind of, you know, went sideways for, you know, basing for, you know, a couple of years, and now it's turning upwards. So, I think we're going to see over time as we move through the year, these initial claims will start climbing. They'll continue to climb, and then that will start to set in, right? These are consumers, you know, these are people that won't have jobs. These are people that will be, you know, eventually, if you're not making money in your company or if you're profits are down or orders are down, you're going to have to lay people off. And then those people can't spend, and you see how things self-reinforce. So my view is there's really nothing to do. I mean, just sit here and clip your coupons. I mean, you should be holding a lot of cash by now. Yes, there's still little things to speculate on, but I think you know, building up cash reserves, putting them in a money market fund or T-bills or something like that, something short term. I wouldn't try to get too cute. Some people are advocating, well, you know, let's go ahead and forecast the recession. Let's go ahead and, you know, start buying, you know, 5 and 10 year treasuries to try to capture the eventual decline in interest rates, which will lead to higher bond prices and capture a capital gain. I don't even want to get that cute. I don't think there's anything to do except for sit here and wait for things to get bombed out, which will happen eventually. I mean, I'm getting ready to talk about some of these housing stocks that are making all-time highs and breaking out. It makes no sense, but you know, that's how the market operates, right? It tries to suck the majority of people in. And maybe I've got this wrong. Maybe we will have a soft landing. Maybe we'll muddle through. Maybe an over-indebted economy that, you know, wasn't growing that fast at zero interest rates will somehow miraculously grow and beat going into a recession at 5% Fed funds rate. I don't think it will, but you know, maybe it can. Anything's possible, I guess. But I think that now this employment's a lagging indicator. It's starting to come through now, and we should see this number. Yeah, there's going to be squiggles in the line, but what's the trend? The trend is up, right? We had this basing pattern. You know, this is a result of the pandemic, you know, stimulus. I mean, they don't show the left side of the chart when we were up here close to 600,000 initial jobless claims, and then as all that stimulus and rate cutting came into the economy during the pandemic, I mean, you saw how fast things plunged, and then we were ticking along here. And now, as rates started rising, this is a lagging indicator, and you see that even back last year, planned layoffs were starting to go up. So we would expect to see this continuing, okay, not reversing. This was only going to reverse after the next liquidity cycle, which we don't know when that's going to start. And so this is kind of what I was talking about. I'll put a link to this guy, this particular person's Twitter thread. They showed this on Twitter. I thought it was interesting. This is D.R. Horton reported last week. And I guess, you know, the stock is close to making or is making all-time highs, even though the underlying fundamentals of the business are not looking that good. But, you know, when you set up on Wall Street to have you lower expectations and then you beat that, you're just moving the goalposts. And does that really mean that, you know, this is bullish for the company, or does it just mean that you're not looking at things, you're looking through things at rose-colored glasses? And so there's always multiple ways to look at things, and you have to be careful when you're looking at different data points. Are these, you know, data points really effective in you know, making predictions on the future, or are they just confirmation bias? So I will just put this up here. I will put a link to the particular person's what do you call it? Twitter feed that explains all this or goes through this in more in depth. You can check it out for yourself. You know, one of the arguments is that, well, we're not going to have a significant decrease in housing prices or, too much problems in residential real estate because so many people locked in such low rates, and a lot of people now are working from home. It's not going to be like the great financial crisis where we had this big plunge in housing. I mean, I guess that argument can be made. The other argument is that, housing has like a put under it just because of the millennial generation, which is the largest cohort of generations, bigger than the baby boomers, are now entering their prime time for creating families and wanting to get their own houses. Anybody listening to this knows that as you get older and you get married and you have children, you're not going to live in, you and your wife living in a one bedroom apartment and saving money. Well, now you got kids coming, you're not going to live like that, right? You're going to want to get a house. You're going to want to be in a good school district. The whole litany. So, that's one of the arguments being made. Well, there's this underpinning of demand because we didn't build enough houses coming out of the great financial crisis, real estate bubble, which is true. Plus, we have this cohort that's looking to buy houses. And so, but my argument is if you don't have a job or if you see the economy deteriorating, if prices really haven't come in yet on houses, how inclined are you going to be able to buy a house? You know what I mean? So, sediment has a lot to play into this, in my view. And so I want to show this D.R. Horton, which is a home builder. Mostly builds like entry level homes. I think ho homes are like under 300,000 or something like that. Track housing, if you will, first time home buyer type situations. And so it says right here, D.R. Horton sales contract backlog value. You can see that there was a, in the quarter they just reported, there was a 44% drop in sales order backlog for D.R. Horton. This is something similar that they saw during the housing bust during the great financial crisis. Now, I'm not saying obviously it's not the same, but I think that this move higher was because of all of the stimulus, because of all, this backlog increased because there was so much cash in the market. Everybody was out there buying houses or rehabbing their houses. Everybody was working from home. Rates were, near, at all-time lows. Like I said, people were getting fixed rate mortgages at 3% and slightly lower. So that enables people to buy more square footage, larger homes. That is now reversing. Excuse me. And what's funny is, D.R. Horton will make is now being close to, if not all-time highs, close to. So the stock is up on this. I mean, the earnings were even down. So I don't know. I didn't follow the prognostications and analysis of Bloomberg and CNBC as to why, these houses, it's not just D.R. Horton, all the housing stocks are on fire. And I just don't see how that's, possible in this overvalued market with rates going up and liquidity tightening. And I think, again, you're starting to see that that's not really the case. And so, again, we'll have to watch it. It's not just a one-off. It's a series of events. It's, if we have a trend going in one direction and we see validation month after month, quarter after quarter, validating the negative news, then at some point it has to be considered negative news and you really can't see the stock, trading at these levels. I think what it is possibly, like I was talking about, it's everybody knows about the demand for houses from the millennial cohort. The fact that there isn't a lot of housing inventory to supply the demand. But again, if prices are high and rates are high, until prices come in, they have to come in substantially to compensate for the higher rates to make the monthly payment affordable. And if you're in a situation where sentiment in the economy, sentiment, general sentiment is bad because people understand the economy is in recession or on the verge of a recession, people are going to be apt to hold off buying houses or canceling contracts or not entering into contracts for a new home if they think that their job is at risk or that the economy could get bad. So, yes, I understand. Again, lumber prices have collapsed. Some material prices are coming in. So that will have an effect too. But overall, what's the trend? And so I think that Maybe there's an anticipation that rates are going to get cut pretty soon, and that will make the housing market take off, which it will. But I think what will happen is these stocks will come in quite a bit as if rates and liquidity stay where they're at in the economy, and we'll have an opportunity to buy them because eventually this thing reverses. And in fact, those people will then be in the market for a house, and there won't be enough houses. And so, but I think we're a distance away from that. I don't think the fundamentals are matching what the anticipation is that's reflected in the current stock prices. Again, this is from that Twitter feed, and I'll put a link to it so you can go through the whole thing. But this is a D.R. Horton ratio of market cap to sales contract backlog. And you see during the Great Financial Crisis real estate bubble, it was 4.06 times. We're now at 5.06 times. This thing just basically, you can see how it deteriorated, as the pandemic lockdowns and the economy was kind of imploding. And then after all the stimulus and massive rate cutting, you see what happened. So I think if you look at, even what the bubble-ish conditions were during the housing bubble in 2008, I mean, we're far exceeding that. And again, just because this shows this doesn't mean it has any validity. It's just, a something that somebody you might be able to take ratio of something else of D.R. Horton to something else, and it shows it's undervalued. I don't know. Again, it's food for thought. It's worth taking a look at. It doesn't make sense to me that people that don't have large wage increases, which is the majority of the population over the last 10 years or more, and have seen housing prices skyrocket, basically double in some cases or more, they're going to be able to go running out and buy houses when we've had the largest and quickest series of rate increases and tightening of liquidity in the economy in a couple generations. How that's bullish for housing, I can't. I can't wrap my head around it. So again, I wanted to show this chart. This is just showing the amount of people in the US of each generation. Here's the millennial generation, basically people that were born between 81 and 1981 and 1996. Basically people in their, like right around 40 and less, so in their early 30s. So that's prime time, where they've established themselves in the career, have a decent amount of income, and are starting families. People start families a little bit later than they did in the past. And so this is where I think a lot of the, I don't want to say euphoria, but anticipation of the housing market and housing stocks, because of the fact, it is a fact that we have underbuilt, and the housing inventory is not sufficient to meet the demand for all these people. So eventually it will be a good investment. I've got several ideas for that for the portfolio when we get into an environment, but that's conducive to being tailwinds to a housing recovery. I don't see that right now. And so we're watching the prices and see if they come in. We like to buy things that are cheap and inflecting, not things that are overvalued. This is a Jesse Felder tweet. There's been a lot of discussion. I was listening, a lot of good discussion on FinTwit and some of the good podcasts I listen to, where we're talking about the US dollar and its relationship to other currencies and the reserve currency status of the US dollar. Look, I don't think the US dollar is going to disappear as a reserve currency anytime soon, but you certainly have to say that the United States hasn't done itself any favors vis-a-vis its relationships with its so-called allies or people it has common interests with. Not only that, the stunts that they've pulled recently trying to overthrow governments or confiscating sovereign nations, money. That does send a message. Again, I've said this before, whether you think that that was a good thing to do or not, you have to look at it from the perspective of these other countries like Saudi Arabia, like these emerging markets like India. It's like, okay, so if we piss the United States off, they're just going to go and what, cut us out of SWIFT because they did it already. Or they're going to go around confiscating our assets and we have no recourse. So why would we want to hold US dollars? So, and you can see this basically, look at this kind of, this is the real change in share, market share as a reserve currency. After steady declines in its global market share for the past two decades, in 2022, the dollar lost market share at a pace 10 times as rapidly. And so I'll put a link to the actual paper that's on this. You can read it for yourself. Now, do I think that, somebody made the crack? I think it was Brett Johnson or somebody I was listening to on a podcast saying, well, you don't see people, vacationing and, in China and, taking and meeting with bankers in St. Petersburg to store their wealth in Russia. And that's very cute and interesting, but it's true. I mean, you can talk to, I think another person was lamenting or telling the story about they were talking to a wealth manager in Switzerland. And, as I said, all these people from the Middle East and Asia and even Russia, people that come and talk to them, they don't ask to store their wealth in their home currency. They want to have dollar investments. So I get that. The US dollar is, in the United States economy, for all of its faults, is still has most, for the most part, rule of law, stability, a large enough market because of its bond markets and things like that, legal precedents. But that's all deteriorating. Okay. And so it's what it is. That doesn't mean everybody's going to be, people are going to be looking to diversify in other things. That's why you're seeing more interest in gold, but everybody's assets can't go into gold or Bitcoin or whatever. So I think those things will pick up market share also. So I don't really know what's going to happen. I do know that the United States has an advantage that probably didn't deserve, that just got by circumstance after World War II, that being the reserve currency. And I don't understand why we're doing everything to squander it. Because without the reserve currency status, your living standard would be substantially lowered. Again, I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon, but it's like Kodak, right? When they made tremendous profits off the silver halide methodology for developing photographs, right? Into pictures or film into pictures. And the margins and profits were so large that when digital photography came along, they didn't want to move into it, even though Kodak, I think, produced the first digital camera. I think you can look that up. You can see like the first picture taken by a digital camera. It's horrible, but they, I think, patented that technology or initiated, or one of the main original discoverers of that. So they just didn't exploit it because they were so set in their ways and had, their philosophy, like, why would we do that when we have such high margins in this current business, which that was going away. It's the same thing here. It's like we are squandering our leadership and not thinking about, how the world's evolving, multipolar world, or the emergence of these other powers that they have. They're going to exist. They have the right to exist. They have interests also, some of which are not going to be aligned with ours. And how do we manage that? And running around the world with your aircraft carriers and threatening to bomb everybody or overthrow their government probably isn't the right way to proceed. So that's why I think over time, you'll probably see more deterioration in people wanting to hold dollars, but I don't think it goes away anytime soon. But it's something to pay attention to. And you have to, like, why is this happening? Is this a trend that's in motion that will continue, or is this just like a one-off and people are going to come to their senses because there's nowhere else to go, so they'll come back? I mean, it's hard to know, right? The politics can change during the next election. We could have a complete change in leadership that's more conducive, that's more diplomatic, that wants to look for win-win situations. I mean, there's all kinds of unknowns involved here, but the current trend is not positive. And having said that, That means you got to be like looking at hard. That's another reason to be looking at hard assets, gold, resource mark, resources, commodities, that type of thing. So I thought this was great. This is liquidity cycle. I think it's from that same paper I was talking about earlier. But anyways, you talk about as liquidity tightens, risk premiums rise and assets fall, growth slows. That's kind of where we're at right now, right? The US, UK, and Europe are kind of in that area right there. What eventually happens, right, is central banks ease, they lower rates, they increase liquidity. Again, liquidity improves, risk premiums fall, asset prices rise, growth rises. Again, you get in the same situation, inflation starts picking up, you start getting bubblicious conditions, the central bank tightens, rinse and repeat. So it looks like, China, Japan, Asia, I don't know if I agree with all of this, that they are kind of moving in this direction. It's definitely, I would say that the US, UK, and Europe are definitely in this area. So I do expect the stock market in the US to decline significantly over the next 6 months to a year. Whether it ends up being a crash or if there's some kind of liquidity event with banks. Again, I've talked about the corporate bond market blowing up. I mean, I don't, it's impossible to know. No one can really know. You can speculate, but like I said, it's like the Warren Buffett quip or the Charlie Munger quip of store, example of you standing at the plate and no, the pitcher continues to pitch and there's no balls or strikes called. And so you stand there until you get something right in your wheelhouse that you can take out of the park. Okay, that's where we're at. You just sit here and this is part of the problem. People don't want to do that. Want to be doing something and they make it so easy. All you have to do is pick up your phone and hit a couple buttons and you can buy and sell, sell and buy, And don't do that. That you're not in a situation right now that's where you've got the deck in your favor. If you want to use a card counting analogy, like in blackjack, sit there and clip coupons. You're getting paid, like I said, 4.5 to 5% in short-term holdings. You just sit here and accumulate cash. Let the pitch come to you. Don't force it. Okay. Wait for things to implode. Okay. Wait for things to come in and become bargains and then buy them. And then by that time, we'll be getting near the end of this liquidity tightening cycle, and then they'll be reversing that. Then you'll have, instead of sailing into the wind, you'll have the wind in your sails. And this is the hard thing to do, right? Again, I try to point out that where you make your money is when you make your buy. When you, what price level you buy at, what value you get is when your profit's determined. If you're buying things very, very cheap that are blown out, that have a potential for a reversion to the mean, and then you're just, you just, we've seen it already in offshore drilling. We saw it in the initial move in uranium stocks, gold stocks recently, Bitcoin mining stocks that I talked about, which I didn't put enough of that on. I just took a little taste of a couple, and that's worked out fairly well. But again, scan the new lows sheet and try to determine, things that are blown out and then deep dive them and see if they have a potential to inflect. And then, what are some of the, there's always an industry that blows up like that. And then you can look at it and say, okay, well, these are the companies that are going to dry up and blow away, but there's some companies that if certain circumstances happen, they'll thrive. So, I mean, it's a simple thing that happened like in the Bitcoin mining thing. So, if Bitcoin, when liquidity improves, we expect Bitcoin is a creature of liquidity. When liquidity is expanding, Bitcoin goes up. When liquidity is, tightening, Bitcoin has a tendency to go down. It kind of, that seems to be the, and so if we're coming, if it's anticipating a liquidity expanding a cycle of expansion, and it actually happens, and say Bitcoin goes to its current 30,000 to 50, 60, 70,000, then you can see a substantial increase in some of these mining stocks. Same thing in gold mining. I've explained it before how that works too. So there's always opportunity, but you have to be patient and you have to understand the cyclical nature and where in the cycle you are This is a good chart that makes it kind of, what do you call it? I don't want to use the word easy because it's not easy, but it gives you it allows you to kind of understand that a little bit easier. And if you just keep this in mind, where are you at in this cycle of liquidity? Because remember, in the short, medium term, and I agree with Druckenmiller on this, I don't agree with him. He's right about it. I mean, it's not like I'm his peer, and I agree. I mean, it's demonstrable, right? In the short, medium term, liquidity and sentiment is what drives these markets. So our last chart here, again, the bleacher bums or the critics will say, well, this data, I don't believe Chinese data. Okay, well, that you don't have to believe Chinese data. I'm just reporting the news. It says, China economy surprises to upside. Chinese economic data blows past forecasts. This is the Citibank China Economic Surprise Index, 19-year period through 2023. So basically, about the last almost 20 years, we've had one of the biggest surprises recently in the Chinese economic data. Again, do you believe the data? Is the data accurate? I'm just reporting it. So I think that the recovery in China post-COVID is maybe not as aggressive as I was hoping, but it is happening. The spending's picking up. But then you can look at other data where manufacturing is kind of lagging because think about it, it's an export economy. If Europe is in recession, if the US is headed for recession, some of its other trading partners, it's not probably going to just be a rocket ship ride, but just trying to get, things like around consumers there back to normal for travel and other things that is slowly but surely recovering. So I just wanted to point this out there again. The bleacher bums and other critics will say, how do I know what the Chinese data is? I'm not there. I mean, everybody says it's not good. I mean, this is Citibank, their analysis. So I just report this. And again, it's something to put into the other data points and see where we're really at. Again, the flight data is showing, at least domestically, that you're back to normal, and international flights now are starting to accelerate. And why do I care about this? Because I'm caring about, as China gets back to its normal oil demand, how is that going to affect the overall oil market in general? Okay, I think that's it for this week. Again, it's a short week. I apologize for the late upload. Was busy doing some personal issues that took up the whole weekend. Again, I'm going to do some more work on this hope thing. I really like it. When I heard the guy from Piper Sandler explain, I was like, man, now I've got this makes total sense to me, clicked with me about the whole method of looking at how rates and increasing Federal Reserve rates or interest rates, how it percolates through the economy, and how you can construct data points to kind of track where you are. And how those lagging effects affect different parts of the economy. So I thought that was interesting. So probably going to require some more study on my part, and I'll report back after I get more information. Okay, guys, that's it for this week. I appreciate you tuning in and being patient with me. I got a lot of DMs and emails. What's going on? With the video, here it is. Again, apologize for the brevity. But again, I do have other things to do in my life besides videos. Okay, guys, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.